Welcome to Inside the Spec. We are the podcast that bridges the gap between building product manufacturers and the architects who specify them. Each episode brings you unfiltered insights into how architects find, evaluate, and specify building materials. I'm your co-host, Megan Kavinsky, and CEO of Point to Point. We're an advertising agency focused in securing the architect's spec through results-focused marketing. And I'm joined by my co-host, Vardhan Mehta, a second-gen architect and founder of AceLab. AceLab is an AI-driven product selection platform that brings architects and manufacturers together early in the design process.
Whether you're a manufacturer looking to better serve the architectural community or a supplier seeking to understand the evolving needs of design professionals, Inside the Spec delivers actionable intelligence straight from the source. Inside the Spec, because understanding how architects think is the first step to becoming the architect standard.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Inside the Spec. I'm Megan Kavinsky. I'm one of our two co-hosts. I'm also CEO of Point to Point. And I am joined by my esteemed co-host, Vardhan Mehta, CEO of AceLab. And today we are particularly excited to have Frank Coppola here from Coppola Brothers. Frank's business is interesting. Frank's got a unique background. He's here today to really give us his perspective as to what it's like to be an owner's rep and what happens in those closed door meetings between architects and the GC and the owner, because so many building product manufacturers are trying to influence the architect and the GC to get to the owner. We're not always allowed in the room. So Frank is an owner's rep, but Coppola Brothers is much bigger than that. And I think, Frank, it's great to have you here. Thank you for joining us today. You could spend a little bit of time introducing yourself and giving us your background and telling us about your business. I think our viewers and Vardhan, because he's not met you before, could really benefit from that.
Well, thank you for having me. It's my least favorite thing, talking about myself. I would much rather talk about others or help other people. So this will be very brief. I'm a statistic. Look, when I went to college, I shouldn't have gone to college. I should have been a plumber. And my generation was a generation where, what do you want to do? Stick your hands in toilets all your life? You got to use your brain. Meanwhile, I was going to college for business management with a concentration in entrepreneurship. And I worked for a plumber during college. And if somebody whispered into my ear, you could own the plumbing business, it would have changed. Just that one little statement would have changed the course of my life. So I didn't do that. I wound up working on Wall Street for 10 years. I traded commodities, and then I traded international equities, both on the buy side, until I literally got stressed out of Wall Street. It was not for me. 10 years, good thing, and I left. And part of my, I had a panic attack. It was bad. And part of my therapy was, well, I was a handy guy. My wife and I had, fixed up a condo, sold it. We had this big house with an unfinished basement. And I was working in my unfinished basement. 6 months went by, no job on Wall Street, made this like MTV crib style basement movie theater with stadium seating for 27 people, a wine cellar game. It was a lot of fun. And a friend of my family said, hey, listen, I don't mean to insult you, but, you want to remodel my kitchen? And my wife was like, come on, get out of the house. So yes. I had a couple of friends of mine that were, looking for some work. So I cobbled the crew together and I said, you know how the world is going to work? I'm going to start this thing. And then 3 days into it, I'm going to get a call from Wall Street and then I'll just hire another contractor. And I was right about one thing, which is the 3 days into it. But it wasn't Wall Street. It was my wife. My wife famously said, oh my God, I got my husband back. And we were talking just before the call. What is unique about this story of mine is I came from the top down. I mean, I had business first and, knew plumb and level. But most people in construction kind of come up through the ranks. They start off in the field and they work their way up. And I didn't. I like sawdust. but I don't have sawdust in my veins. My, you know, senior project manager, second generation builder has sawdust in his veins. And the last part of the story, which I think will set it up nicely for this conversation, is I only work for friends and family or people that I'm going to be friendly with. I don't subscribe to that theory, business is business and you should separate friends and family. I think that's complete BS. I mean, the most successful anything, products, right? I mean, Tesla owners love their Teslas. Ferrari owners love their, you know, you have any product, anything, you know, you're on Team Lowe's because you like the store, you like their stuff. So this whole idea of a fan base is, if you started from that perspective of just wanting to take care of your peeps, whomever they are, right? The best manufacturers are obsessed with their customers, obsessed with their product, right? Steve Jobs and Apple, obsessed with their product. So my business kind of came from that end, and I really was tired of seeing people get hurt from bad contractors. And what led me into the owner's rep space, and I'm almost done, is I've had friends of mine call me up and go, listen, I have a contract that's gone wild. Can you help? And or somebody else is really in trouble. I don't know what to do. Can you help? And so our business evolved from being built on super high-end owner-occupied residential remodeling to our owner's rep division, where we help, you know, not just homeowners and condo boards with contractors gone wild. And very, very, very hard thing to do to balance all the parts or get the wheels back on the cart. And there's not just four wheels on some of them. So I hope that frames it for you as to who I am and why I'm here.
I mean, that's a wild story, but also in some way makes total sense that you went after the passion. And I really like the point you also made about like working with people you're friendly with. I mean, if there's any industry where that makes all the sense in the world, it's probably the construction industry, right? Like we're so driven by the relationships and trust and who you know and how well are you able to trust them. So that makes a ton of sense. I think Fran, just like to set the stage, I'm sure we've got our audience here where some people know the role of an owner's rep on a project, and there also may be people who are new to the industry in general or haven't had to deal with owner's reps on a project in the past from like the sales, marketing, et cetera, teams from manufacturers. It'd be very helpful if you could even just maybe summarize the role of an owner's rep and then what usually is like in scope, like how do you operate with the architect, the contractors on a project?
Sure. So I'll start. Most people aren't aware of the role unless you do super high-end projects, like super high-end, like baseball stadiums or, you know, skyscrapers. And if you looked up the AIA, the Architect Institute of America, they have a suite of documents. And that's where you find the owner's rep. It's actually called the construction manager as advisor. So construction managers can act in two different roles. They can act as an advisor, or they can act as the construction manager as constructor. So in the residential space, the construction manager as constructor is a general contractor, and the construction manager as advisor is the owner's rep. The owner's rep sits in the organizational tree at the same level as the architect and the owner. And then everybody else reports to them, or not just reports, but is under them. And the owner's rep, if you think about it in the commercial space, because you don't have a single owner, right? You have a board of directors that is financing the baseball stadium. So they need somebody to interface with the architect and the contractor. So they have an individual or a firm that is going to act that speaks two languages, right? That speaks blue collar and white collar, which was kind of funny. And I'll just circle back. So, you know, I spent 10 years in the white collar world, but my weekends were spent in the blue collar world always. So I've always bridged this gap and have been able to speak to the guys with the, you know, tool belts on and the folks with their spreadsheets and their, you know, their pens and their checkbooks in their hand. So the owner's rep fills that void. It's agnostic. A good owner's rep is the advocate for the project, right? Is for the project. So there are times in the owner's rep, you know, proverbially puts the hand on the contractor's shoulder and says, listen, we got to do it this way. And at the same time, or in another instance, we'll go to the owner and say, I don't think that's realistic. And these are difficult conversations to have, which is why it's really important to set it up correctly in the beginning.
Do you think it's fair to say that the owner's reps essentially act as the mediators between the architects and the contractors sometimes, and that, you know, I'll go with the stereotype in our industry, right? Like architects are always optimizing for the quality, sometimes not in touch with realities of the project, like the cost, schedule, etc. On the contractor side, of course, the stereotype is optimizing for cost.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't have teed this up better. This is not scripted. That's a great question. So I think there's a misconception, or is that construction projects are linear. And that's, to me, drives me crazy, because I see so many problems happen because it starts with an architect. Most architects do not even ask questions about the budget. They get their pen out. They'll do something. They'll do a preliminary sketch. The owner gets excited about that sketch. And then maybe they'll put an RFP, a request for proposal, or a set of plans. And then it goes to the builder. And then the builder is trying to land the job. Most builders, you know, do free estimates, which are just disgusting. I think they should be just outlawed. And if I could have one wish, it would be that our industry, the construction industry, just doesn't do free estimates any more than a lawyer or a doctor or any other professional just gives away something for, like, it's just dumb. So you have this situation where it's the telephone game, right? It goes, owner gives the architect an idea they have in their head. The architect says, great. They take that, they get an outline for it. Now it goes to the contractor. The contractor has to put numbers on it. These numbers come back. It goes back to the owner, and there's now misalignment. Because nobody in the conversation was having the conversation about the other party, which is the budget. So when you do it linearly like that, it's just a recipe for divergence. So the way I like to have the conversations, and I take no credit for this any more than having blue eyes, is just not being afraid to talk about money, is the first question I have when I sit people down is, to the architect, what budget did you draw to? To the owner, what budget? Now, the owner wants to spend a little bit, but you got to have a conversation. It's like a restaurant. Like, what restaurant do you want to go to? Are we at the all-you-can-eat buffet? Are we at the 4-star, 5-star restaurant, or are we at your country club? And I've had all those types of clients where, you know, and money's always an object. Just let's be clear. It's always an object. There are, in the reality we live in. So if you have the conversation with the owner, not only about the budget, but where's the budget coming from? Is it cash in a mattress? Is it a HELOC, which is the worst thing to do in construction as far as financing goes? There should be a construction loan, and most people don't even know those exist, right? Or, you know, how are you capitalizing this? What's the purpose? There's that whole layer of finance nobody has. Like, nobody has. An owner's rep will have that conversation. And it's because, and I think about this, the owner's rep is there to make sure this project will succeed. But there has to be a project that will succeed. It's got to be set up to succeed in the beginning. And so it's amazing that construction projects happen all, because there's such misalignment in budget and scope, in product and actual effectiveness, because, you know, it's just crazy that it actually happens, but rarely is it what anybody thought it was going to be in the beginning. So the owner's rep job is to kind of let that manifest so it stays true to the original intent.
I think that's really interesting that that you're saying that the architect hasn't been given a budget for the project at the inception. And
sometimes.
In my experience in talking with architects, because we do a lot of different architect interviews, and certainly Vardan, I mean, he is an architect, you know, that they have, like, we use the example, we talk a lot about, like, what kind of car am I buying? You know, like your restaurant example, that the architect does have an idea about what the budget needs to cost. I mean, my clients all are giving architects estimates for, you know, in schematic design for a lot of the different projects that they're working on. So Vardan, do you see that same, is that your experience from when you were an architect about the budget?
I think it is, but maybe just to explain how I interpret Frank's feedback is that architects often don't know how to price things. And so in the early stages, an architect might be showing renderings of a space and they might be showing steel windows. And now the owner is very excited. But, you know, what the architects don't know is, like, based on the cost, the project, other dynamics, we can really afford only vinyl. And so, like, there's a disconnect there. And if you don't address that in the early stages of the project, then in the later stages, that leads to rework. You have to have a lot of meetings about this headache. Sometimes it could be that stuff that architects found were almost too unique that was embedded in the design. And now the contractors are struggling to figure out how to meet the design intent. And again, you have to go back to the drawing board and there's, like, reevaluation of the design, what's important, what's not. But I'll let Frank maybe opine on if that's the reality that you're seeing.
It used to work.
Yeah.
I mean, it used to work. I mean, I've been in business for 23 years, right, in construction. For 18 years, prices were stable. You know, I mean, I can't even tell you how many cookie cutter projects I did. And you could just see by the type of stove they picked out, whether it was a LeCornu or a GE, what the delta was on the project. But look where we are here. I got a perfect example, real time. I saw the headline yesterday on the news. The price of gasoline from February 22nd to March 22nd went up $1 a gallon.
Yeah.
So just think about that one price. Like, prices are fluctuating all over the place right now. Orders of magnitude where, you know, so if you're not on the front lines and you're not sophisticated enough to price something to allow for that delta. Now, this is an important thing, right? You think about it. And I'm not casting aspersions at the architect because there's such a delay between drawing this and speccing this thing out. But there's a whole different layer now of sophistication needed to allow for this price disruption. So if you're, and I'll give you an example. So if it's being drawn to not to exceed pricing, right? Not to exceed. The builder is going to give a number. I'm going to build this thing for X. Well, because of the volatility, the vol index is so high, they are going to pad that estimate heavily to make up for the volatility. Because who gets paid to handle the risk and price fluctuations? We do that when we act as the contractor. We do cost plus. We do open book because inflation kicked in a few years ago, I did not want my friends and family thinking that I was, and I, we don't sell fuel, but I'm going to use that as an example. I didn't want anybody thinking that I was charging them $5 a gallon for gasoline that was costing me two. I would just rather show the receipt for my costs and just show what my margin and overhead is on top of it, because I was not going to let my brand, which is trust, suffer. So there's a whole different player in the room, let alone, now I got to say those two letters, AI, because now everybody thinks they know everything. What is the average cost for a construction project in the mid? And it's going to barf something out that is just, it's just not correct. So it's the dance, there's a few more dance partners in this equation now. And it's just, I think you just got to recognize it. You can't have, like, woeful blindness anymore. Homeowners love to do that. I love to pick on a homeowner a little bit when they have their project and it's all set and then you're kind of going through it and then they take that finger out. Well, you know, I'd really like to add that thing over there. I go, wait, that finger is very expensive.
What are you pointing at? Every time you get that finger out, you don't have the eraser in your hand. You have the finger out. So that's a fun way to say, you know, when things change, when you make any decision in a project, this is Captain Obvious now. You change a decision, it's going to change the time and the cost instantly.
I'm thinking about my basement remodel and wishing I had you around to talk to my husband about that finger when we were doing our cost plus basement remodel. So Frank, in what you're describing, it's interesting. And it is, you're talking probably post COVID, because I feel like every year there's something, right? There was COVID, mm-hmm. there was supply chain issues, there was interest rate, you know, now we have
regulation. How about regulation costs?
Yeah. You know, there's always something, right? So what do you see the best architecture firms and what do you see the best contractors general, like, You talked about, you know, pricing and volatility. You know, what does that look like from a real world perspective?
The real world is the practicality of over communicating in the beginning. And look, I have to give a shout out to my senior project manager. You know, you have to go slow sometimes in order to go fast. You really have to plan this out. You got to just plan it out. You got to spend much more time planning it out, making all these decisions, building out your fixtures and furnishing schedule. And if you don't know, if you don't know what the faucet package is, well, great. Well, then leave a healthy allowance in it. And at least go back to you, Megan, about the car, right? Okay, are these wall-hung toilets that designer is going to be speccing out, or are they the standard sitting on the floor? I mean, there's a huge delta in the price in that from not just the cost of the fixture, but the installation of it. So I just think it's over communicating really helps to bring the project in focus, all components, architect's vision, contractor, owner's expectation, finance, bringing all of those together and then having that so there's not much of a delta, right, before the project starts. I mean, the most successful, to answer your question directly, look, the bigger and the fancier the architectural firm is, they release those plans. There are no changes. That's it. It's done. You know, there is no revisionist history. They spend all their time to make sure that their vision is the vision. And then it goes out for an RFP. And then maybe there's some value engineering. And we can pick on a hot water heater, and the architect specs the ABC 2000, and the plumbing contractor likes the XYZ 123. Okay, well, then you have that conversation. You still bid it to the plans, you provide an alternate. That's straightforward stuff. That happens all the time. And you haven't asked this question, but I have one other thing, maybe just to pivot the conversation a little bit. You know, we did this really, really nice whole house remodel down in West Palm Beach. And the designer spec'd this really cool thing. Really cool thing. It was like a hidden cabinet door that opened up to a laundry room. It was awesome. So if you looked at the kitchen, you had no idea there was a laundry room behind this wall because they wanted to make the whole wall, right? High-end, super-duper hinges. They were the coolest things. You know, came from Germany. It was great. Fine. It comes. The architect's like, you're going to love these things. Fantastic. Designer's like, make it happen. They come. And there are no instructions. There are none. And, you know, it's not like this is only a few years ago. It's not like, you know, this was from the 1800s, something that came in. So the cut sheet was there. So cut sheet says what it's made of, you know, how many screws are in a thing. But it was as far from IKEA instructions as you could be. And we had really talented craftsmen in there. And, oh my gosh, that install took a week instead of 2 days. That's a little granular example. But the reason I'm bringing it up is that divergence between owner and architect and contractor. For the suppliers out there, what's interesting is you have multiple audiences. You've got your ad slick, which is going to go in the store or your dealership that says what it is it good for the environment, da, 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 da. You've got your spec sheet for the architect, that's going to say, okay, how many square feet does this thing cover? What are the load tolerances? What are the power, like all that stuff. And then there's a contractor out there that, okay, do we need a certified installer to do this? Is that mentioned? Because most contractors are like, certified, I'll figure it out. But is there enough information there to, and this is a problem now, this is another problem, is that the skilled craftsmen of today are not the skilled craftsmen of yesterday. I mean, I can't tell you, it's really sad how many people are like, you know, in the field watching YouTube videos, trying to figure stuff out. That is a new reality across the world. I mean, I could wax poetic on this, but that is a storm that is coming. And I think the manufacturers out there need to realize that you have this new choke point here of actually getting it in the real world. Like, I mean, AI is coming, and I know the AI robots are coming, but not tomorrow. I mean, yes, but you know, what percentage of projects out there are not ground up and that aren't being done by 3D? There's plenty of, you know, I'm sure, you know, you both know, you need a plumber in the middle of the night. You're not calling, you know, Gemini or Grok to get you a plumber, right?
Well, everyone's so calling Bob these days, Frank. It's only Grok. Well, but what's funny, I was thinking about it when you were starting the story at the beginning, because you're like, you know, everyone was telling me, you know, to go to school. And if someone had said, hey, you could go to school to like own the, you know, HVAC, like that would have been a good path, right? Because, well, one, that whole trend within that segment right now has been very interesting to watch. But two, because of AI, there is this whole rise and a lot of people are going back to looking at the trades as viable, but more from the lens of what you're talking about, because it is something that it's going to be harder to replace from a robot than some of the initial adoption of AI. So the example that you gave about the install, I thought was interesting, because I haven't really seen a manufacturer, at least stateside, that didn't have installation instructions. And it got me thinking about, what are the things that you see from a manufacturer as an owner's rep? You know, I'm thinking about some of the stuff that we've created for some of our clients, like a couple of facade clients. We have like total cost of ownership. You know, we have labor savings or energy savings messaging that we're trying to get in front of them, because like you mentioned, you know, the labor shortage is real. And actually AI, I think, might make it better in the short term, because as, you know, AI replaces some of these other entry level jobs, the trades are a place where, you know, are desperately in search of people. But what is that information that you're looking for from a manufacturer, from an architect, or from the GC on the job to educate you about a product?
So, you know, in this day and age, not saying you, Megan, but you know, everyone wants like a, what's the key? What's the secret? It's not one thing. It's, to me, there's, you know, you have some manufacturers that are really good at one thing and others that aren't. It's like, you know, if you can amalgamate them all, I'll go back to AI for a second. So one of the things, if you, you know, when you get over the hump and you realize that AI is not just a query engine, you can make it as a, you know, thought partner, trusted advisor, act as my paralegal, act as my, you know, chief risk officer. So you have different roles and different audiences. So for manufacturers, look, I think everybody likes things that actually work.
Yeah.
I cannot tell you how many times I have had, you know, some stuff is obvious, right? Not meant for saltwater applications. You know, indoor use only, there's obvious stuff. But there's also like non-obvious stuff where, you know, you get in the fine print. My sister did a shower for, and she bought this beautiful glass tile. Whomever sold that tile should have actually made it mandatory that this type of mastic should be used with our tile, because it's glass. And even though it had a little paper backing, the paper backing, when you typical tile install, is you wind up seeing the lines from the thinset behind the tile.
And I was like, oh my gosh, this would have been just is so avoidable. But I wonder if the manufacturer actually went and into the field and saw what their tile looked like when it was installed, if that feedback loop made it all the way back, right? I don't know. But, you know, it's like, I'm an Elon Musk fan. Elon Musk, you know, famously said, don't tell me what you like about my cars. Tell me what you don't like. And unless you are seeking that feedback, because now you have all these different players in this chain, right? So I'm not trying to dodge your question, but it's not one thing. It's looking at it and saying, okay, think about all the hands that product is going through. And I mean, I could pick on, super, super fancy high-end appliances. My customer loved them. Great. Architect's like, okay, it'll fit. Great. We got in there. The really fancy things were not designed to be used by a chef. They were showpieces. It was, and she actually wanted to cook with her stuff. It wasn't supposed to be just a show off, you know, appliance. So, you know, sorry, that's just direct feedback. Is this practical? Is this going to be used, right? I mean, if you buy a Ferrari, chances are you're not going to be, road racing it or putting it, but maybe some of you are, and at least then that collector knows what they're buying. Does that make sense? I hope I'm steering this in the right direction. It's just much more complex, and it's not going to get answered by query. It's, you need that real, you, and I'll give you one more. I'll give you another real world. This is not as exciting for a supplier in our universe, but look, I mean, I get spec'd steel beams all the time. Architect specs out WR40, 20 feet long. It's like, okay, great. Except I can't get a crane into the house to do it. We actually have to get it into the house. And unless you have the experience of the practicality of installing this and know, okay, maybe flitch plates would be better because we can have 10 men get it in there, or I can get it through the window. Like, those things happen not in new construction, in remodeling.
Yeah, remodel is always trickier, I think.
It's you got to grow up with it. But that's the point I would make with now today, because you don't have folks that necessarily grew up with the pencil behind the ear and are installing it, and homeowners that aren't reading the fine print. I mean, I'll pick on the tile industry one more time. Is like, we get this tile, we get a sample, and we go and put it on the floor and put water on it. And then, okay, take your shoes off, step on it. Because I don't want, my mom stepping in, somebody's mom stepping in that bathroom and then cracking their head because it looked pretty. Right. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not in the weeds that much. If they say, like, for outdoor use, if they say for shower floors, recommend
the application.
But so I hope that helps. I just think that manufacturers, knowing that it's going to go from multiple people, you know, from the installer, the apprentice to the expert, from the homeowner, from the, you know, oblivious to the, you know, person that's really into it, wants to know it works. You just have a bigger audience now because everything's getting specialized, right? We're in a hyper specialized world now.
I have a fun idea. What if we gave Frank, Megan some hypotheticals, situations that probably happen on a real life project, and ask Frank how he would, or his firm would, navigate that? And of course, we'll do it from the lens of, like, stuff that'll be insightful for manufacturers across their sales, marketing, or product teams that might be listening into this. Yeah. Should we do it? Frank, you down?
I stretch my hamstrings before I'm ready.
Yeah.
All right. An architect wants, to your example earlier, ABC 1000. The contractor wants XYZ 2000. The owner says, Frank, I defer to you. I'll let you mediate to a decision. How do you go about it?
Great question. My knee-jerk reaction was collaborative architects. It's very interesting because it's
it's best practices, right? You're comparing why, and you have that conversation between the architect and the GC, right? But let's just say they cost the same because budgets, just for the sake of this conversation. Where the friction happens is where the architect is like, well, I spec this, I want this used, and then puts, and I'm not saying this happens, this is, but this can happen, is you get an architect that's, you know, how dare you question me?
Or my holy spec.
My holy spec, or they're in a position because what was oblivious to the contractor was the homeowner changed their mind 10 things and the architect has job fatigue and now is displacing the job fatigue on the contractor, which really came from the homeowner, because job fatigue is a real thing. It happens. It just happens. So then it takes that, as you said before, this like mediator approach of sitting here and saying, okay. And then the contractor can't be dogmatic either because he doesn't want to learn how to use the other thing. So I'll circle back to that's where you have to kind of go slow to go fast and sit here and look at this and say, all right, we got disparity. This is easier for an owner's rep, right? If I'm not the contractor, because I can sit there and say to the GC, all right, why do you want to use this? The architect, why do you want to do this? Weigh the cost of it and then come back with the recommendation on behalf of the owner. I mean, that because not to sound self-promoting, but that's where owner's rep really can provide value because they're only there to benefit the project. They're not there to take sides. They're there to get the thing done and get it done right, get it done on budget or as close to as possible. So that's where it helps, you know, but it's a super niche. I mean, this is a small niche. There's no owner's reps are us. Sorry, I'm aging myself. Like,
well, go get that domain. What if, Frank, I'm a brand new product in the US. I've been used internationally to great success, but there's no US specific examples that I'm able to give of my product. How does an owner's rep process that?
Wow. So it's,
yeah.
Maybe it's
like it's, I have a it's lot actually of that are like, yeah. You know, it seems to me like right now there's a lot of Australian building products companies that are coming to the US for the, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with them in particular recently, and they have great installations in Australia, or they even have some Asia, Europe, but it's not a known product in the US. And a lot of times there's labor savings. A lot of times these products have more sustainable material innovation behind them, but it is not proven stateside yet.
Yeah.
How does the owner's rep process the risk with this new product in our market?
I get asked this all the time. This is the chicken and egg, right? You need proof of concept in order to get the concept, you know, being viable. And so you need a beta tester. It's like, this is any founder story, breaking the market, you know, any business, right? When you go from one state to another and you're unknown, it's very, very hard. I don't think as an owner's rep, we've really seen too many of those just because we're in a super, like, I don't think I've seen that, but I don't think there's any way around it. The fact that, yes, especially, I mean, Australia, I mean, that's a hurdle. It's not like you can go up to...
you can't send a guy to go check it out.
Up there to do it.
Talk to someone.
And I think the answer to that is methodically. That's the word that comes out, is to methodically get it. Look, it also depends on the project. You know, if you have... You know, what is the scale of it? What's the risk on it? Right? Is one of the top 10 home builders going to go take a project and just go put it in 300 homes? Probably not. Is the incentive going to be to a medium-sized contractor that's looking to save some and can put it in like one of the 10 houses, you know, find the smaller one that they can and give them an incentive? But I think at the end of the day, it's... Even in our, I mean, this goes back to the whole reality of we're in the real world, right? We're in the real world.
this isn't a piece of software you can put on your computer, and if you don't like it, just delete it, right? There is the practical impact of this is real world. And for a manufacturer to race towards that problem, race towards it and go, we need to get this in the real world somehow, not just at the International Builder Show in a booth with the ShamWow guy demonstrating it, right? It's like boots on the ground. What is your beta test? How are you going to do it? How are you going to send it? And then building that into your marketing is because I just see such a divergence happening. And I go back to AI. It's IQ versus EQ, this barbell effect that's happening between the real world and what looks good on paper. I mean, there is just a cavern now in between the person that actually knows how to do the thing or the person that thinks they know how to do the thing.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, two other ways we could go at this. One of them is one of the trends that came about from, well, the COVID recession and even before that was that architecture firms lost a lot of their spec writers that were going through and doing the detailed work about the integration of systems within a job site. And AIA does this great research every year, the Architect's Journey to Specification. They did one year specifically where they really looked at the relationship of architects and GCs and saw that GCs were increasingly taking on roles that architects had done previously in terms of what you're talking about and the understanding of the building science of construction, really, you know, and what's compatible and what's not. I don't know as much about what's happened post-COVID. Like, do you see this in real life? Like, do you feel that in terms of what you're seeing from the architects to the GCs and who's understanding material compatibility, steps to install, you know, like the viability, like you're describing with the steel beams of construction. Do you see that coming more from the GC than the install community than the
architect? I think this disparity is widening in all industries. There's no middle anymore of any industry. You have either the hyperscalers, the hyper successful top tier firms, or the ones that are really small, no overhead, empowered now to get into the trades because they can learn from AI and they found the niche. But the middle of anything is a very hard space to compete in. So look, in the Florida Home Builders Association, we have 9,000 businesses. I serve the Florida Home Builders Association as the secretary. And so I'm dealing with all of our top architects, the ones that are really killing it right now, are the ones that now have showrooms with, you know, using technology now to map the size of the room out and have a whole wall with the screen so they can project what the room's going to look like, because the ability to visualize in your head is just something that is not being done anymore. Why? We can wind down on a really fun real world example. Why do you think, I'm going to quiz you two now. Why do you think people nowadays can't conceptualize the 3D world? I can't imagine it. They look at a set of plans. They don't see it. Hey.
We spend too much time on social media. Isn't that the reason?
It's very simple. It's because you're not. Look, I grew up with Legos. And my, yeah. And my sisters, you know, and we all played outside. We dealt with the physical world and we were all playing outside. Go play in the traffic, as my grandmother would say. We go outside and now you're in a two-dimensional world all the time. So you're not visualizing. It's not native. It's not instinctual. So these top firms are now compensating and realizing that, well, they just can't, they literally can't see it in their head, right? You take a contractor or an architect, they'll look at a piece of paper that's, you know, drawn out and they see it in their head. Mm-hmm. The GC is problem solving. How does that beam get in their head because of the practicality of construction science? That is exactly, Megan, what I was talking about is, you know, it's not necessarily architect versus GC
who are compensating for each other. It's compensating for this now unintended consequence of technology, you know, which is just moving so much faster than the real world. And then not understanding, you know, it's like, it's the old thing. You ever hear about the one, Henry Ford, you know, whatever, one of the machines on the assembly line didn't work. And he hired this, you know, mechanical super genius. And the guy sat there for six hours, got up, took a piece of chalk, marked it on the machine and said, the problem's right here, and sent a bill to Henry Ford for $10,000. $1 for the chalk and $9,999 to know where to look. Yeah. That skill set of knowing where to look is really where there's such great opportunity now for manufacturers, for everybody in this space, is to find this hole now, which is here. We all see it. And now address that. That's where I think manufacturers should go, is really start thinking about how the manufacturer can compensate and make it easy for everything that's happened. There's a saying on Wall Street, right? As goes Main Street, goes Wall Street. So the problems that we're facing, you know, in the parking lot at the shopping center, going, who designed this parking lot? I mean, like, it'll look good on paper, but there's no practicality. Or why am I slipping on? Like, there's real world answers here to that real people are going to solve. And that's where I think the opportunity lies. So I hope this helps.
That is an amazing, I mean, I think it's an amazing insight. And some manufacturers, I feel like, Frank, are starting to see the same trend. Like, more recently, like the manufacturers who make lighting fixtures, I'm starting to see the websites be a little bit more animated, where like it's not just a, you know, like a static image of the fixture, but actually there's a mode which you can like turn on, and the same things, the same images, it starts to show you what is, you know, the light emission like, what's the spread like on the website. We're also seeing manufacturers that make products that can be, are the main application is for retrofits or renovations, like do the Amazon thing where you can like place it in a room. Like, I think there's stuff like that, which I think even for manufacturers is very important, just because thinking back to the food chain, if you don't sell the architect, they're not going to influence, like they won't champion you with the owner's rep, you know, the owner, the contractor. And so you almost have to like sell at every step of the food chain. If you don't do a 100%. Great job with the insulation instructions, now the next time that German manufacturer is recommended by a very excited architect to the owner's rep or the GC, you guys will shut them down. You'll be like, they're a pain to work with because their insulations don't make any sense, or just like they don't have that. And so I do feel like that's the kind of thing for manufacturers so important, like knowing where are the levers you need to pull with every single stakeholder on the project team. But it's hard. It's like there's so many people and there's so many things to get right, to get the spec interest and then to hold it through, like throughout the project, right?
Yeah. This is why you're the host. This is it. This is why you nailed it. We came all the way back to the beginning. It's that whole circle of, you know, scope, price, implementation, design. You're not just designing a blister pack to sit on a shelf anymore.
Mm.
It's what you just said, boy. That is the soundbite for this this podcast. I'm glad we got there.
No, the soundbite was the insight. Just because, again, like as a manufacturer, I don't think these things are intuitive, and you don't find out, you don't get the feedback unless you ask for it. And again, to your point earlier, so many manufacturers don't invest in that, to go to a job site to see the insulation after they have the order, you know, like they did all of the things, they just sort of go chase the next thing. But hopefully this ends up being an insight for manufacturers to seek feedback at every stakeholder from the project team.
That'd be great. It'd be really great to you know, one day say, you know, I watch this podcast and I hope this inspires like an aha moment for a manufacturer sitting in there, and you know, it helps everybody in the chain. I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and spend this time with you both. And I hope your audience finds it valuable. And and that we get to do it again sometime.
Yeah, that was great, Frank. You had a lot to offer, you know, our audience in terms of just understanding really the current state of construction and specification and how those worlds are interacting with one another. There's a lot of great takeaways and insights from what you shared with us today. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you.